my thing is that investors had it so good for so long, there comes a time when you have to give up some of it. You know, you just can't have it this good for so long and make all this money and then think that, oh, it's just going to keep on going.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Thanks for joining us for part two of our interview with macro analyst Wolf Richter. If you haven't yet watched part one of our discussion with Wolf, in which he explains that while he sees a coming recession as probable, the data suggests it will take longer to arrive than many are currently expecting. Head over to our channel at youtube.com/Wealthion and watch it there first. It sets the context for the investment themes we discuss in this video. And here in part two, we also discuss what to do if you're one of the many investors feeling caught like a deer in the headlights by the losses in the market since the start of this year. You're not alone. A lot of people feel that way. But paralysis is not a good wealth protection strategy. So we discuss a few ways to get unstuck. Okay, let's get started watching part two of our interview with Wolf Richter. You say you think we're going to start seeing prices come down in the data over the next, I'll say, quarter or two. When do you think we'll kind of be at the full effect of seeing the full brunt of a housing market price correction? And given the data that you can see right now, and you can totally change it as more data comes in later on, how big of a decline do you see out here on average?
Well, the way I looked at it, if you're in a city where over the last 18 months, home prices have risen 30%. And so the housing market correction in that city takes prices down to where they were 18 months ago. You know, you really haven't done a lot of damage to the housing market, you know, because not that many people bought a house in 18 months. You know,
it's right. And I think you might have been putting your splendid bubble posts out 18 months ago too, right? I mean, we've had an elevated housing market for a good while, right?
Right. So, you know, so when you look in terms of the damage to the economy, you know, that the home prices have spiked so much that if they go back down to where they were 18 months ago, the damage to the economy is going to be minimal. You know, it's just like a chimera, you know, it came and went. And so, okay, so we had a cloud and it's gone. And the damage will come to the economy when prices go back further, you know, so go back many more years and it'll draw in more home buyers that bought, you know, 4 years ago. And so now they're underwater. But yeah, if they plan to stay in the house and make the mortgage payments, nothing happens to them. You know, I mean, they got the 30-year fixed rate mortgage, that's not gonna change. And if they don't sell the house, they don't really care what it's worth. And they just can't draw money out of it and they can't refi. I don't see a lot of damage from the housing market until, you know, it goes down a whole lot. And that's how I look at it. You know, the Fed got really serious last time about the housing market, about the crash, when it started taking down the financial system. You know, and I don't think we're going to see that for a while, you know. I mean, we have this huge spike, and so that spike gets unworked, it's not going to hurt anything. And then if it goes down further, you know, there'll be some damage, there'll be some losses, and the banks are not sitting on these mortgages anymore to that extent. They've all been securitized. It's investors own them, and the Fed owns them, and pension funds and mutual funds own them. So it's not really the banks anymore that are on the hook. You know? So I don't think the Fed is very eager to step into it this time, especially with high inflation, because the damage will be lower. So this housing market could go down quite a bit. It could go down very slowly. And we've seen that in many other markets, you know, where it's not a sudden plunge, but it's a drawn out process, ups and downs, you know, on a downward trend, and where housing corrects, you know, over many years. You know, just like stock markets corrected over decades in other countries. And, you know, so this is a scenario I'm seeing here. I don't really expect a big financial crisis where everything just collapses and housing collapses. I expect a much more drawn out process of home prices correcting slowly, and maybe there'll be some, you know, some faster declines than slowly. But I mean, the first hump, when that gets worked off, and that could get very, that could be very quick, you know, but the rest of it, I think it's just going to be a slow decline because everything is so overvalued, you know, that, and you're still going to have people buying homes because still people are living in homes. And so long as the financial system doesn't collapse, you know, there's lots of room for this to correct over many years.
All right. So you're making the case for sort of a long, slow deflation in housing prices. Of course, everything in real estate is local, right? So your mileage is going to vary depending upon what market you live in. But just sort of listening to you, Wolf, I'm kind of getting the vibe that you're thinking like prices could be down like 50 plus percent, you know, at the nadir of this, because you're saying 30% just gets us back to 18 months ago, right?
Yeah, from the peak, if you measure from the peak, you know, if you measure from a year and a half ago, prices might be down 20%. And, you know, so if your baseline is a year and a half ago, you know, prices, the way I see it, is going to go down, but they're not going to go down 50% from that. So I don't really take this exponential hump we've had seriously, you know, because it hasn't really done anything. Not that many people have bought homes, you know, during that time period. Yeah, so that's going to go away. That hump's going to go away pretty quickly, I think.
Right.
And
Although people have done the mental math on, oh, well, my house is worth a lot more now.
yeah. And then I think from that point on, and so after that hump has dissipated, you know, from that point on, I think we're looking at a fairly slow, uneven trend downward until, and inflation is going to wage increases are going to bring up the amount of money people can spend, so that's going to support it over time, you know, and I think so that over many years this will work out somehow.
All right. Well, it'll be interesting, and we'll be back on to, you know, call audibles on this. I'm going to go back to Powell for a second with his, you know, I'm out here to bring demand down. And he basically said multiple times in his last press conference, you know, job market, I'm coming for you, right? And to your point, I think the Fed had been sort of loath to go after housing in the past because so many more people own houses. That it's in many cases it's people's biggest asset, you know, on their balance sheet. And the Fed didn't want to, you know, create this sort of negative wealth effect, but I think it now wants to do that, and housing might be one of the more efficient ways to do that. So you crimp jobs and you bring housing prices down. That begins to really diminish demand. So I don't know. I mean, we'll see. We'll see. All right. Well, look, getting to the financial markets now. You wrote recently, in terms of asset prices, there's a rug pull going on. The Fed has embarked on rate hikes, will soon embark on quantitative tightening after interest rate repression and QE have inflated nearly all asset prices to often ridiculous levels. So that's where the action will continue to be. So what's your outlook for the markets from here? You've already mentioned a couple of times you think that it's going to get pretty ugly.
Yeah, and you know, it's already gotten ugly. I mean, it's brutal out there. If you invest in a portfolio of high flyers, you know, you may be down 80%. You know
Yeah.
that.
And I mean, you and I both live in the San Francisco Bay Area, where I would say more people on average have a lot of tech in their portfolios.
Yeah.
You know, now the generals, the big FANG companies are beginning to stumble, but if you weren't a big FANG company, a lot of those companies are down like
Yeah.
50, some like 80, even 90%.
90%. I mean, this started in February a year ago. So then stock by stock it knocked down. And then in November, you know, it's the big ones, Microsoft peaked and some of the other, you know, a lot of the companies actually peaked in November and have downdrafted since then. And yeah, the Nasdaq's down something like 30% already, I think, from November peak and close to it. And I mean, this is, of course, during the dot-com bust, and that's what I compare this to. The Nasdaq went down 78%, and there was a huge, gigantic bear market rally in the summer of 2020, where the Nasdaq surged 35%. Yeah, it didn't go anywhere near its previous high, but you know, there's a huge bear market rally going on, and that drew more people in, and then they got all taken out the back and battered, you know, so I expect a bear market rally. I don't think this is straight down. You know, we're going to have a huge bear market rally, But the stocks that are in the Nasdaq, a lot of them have just gotten completely crushed. You're talking about hundreds of stocks that are down 70, 80, or 90%. Yeah. So this is brutal what's going on out there. Except, Apple's been doing pretty well. Some of the big ones haven't really dropped that much. So it's kind of covered up the surface of at the index level. But when you look at the individual stocks, so I think this will continue. A lot of these stocks will go out of business. Now, those stocks will go to zero, and some of those SPACs and IPOs, many of those SPACs won't make it, so you'll have a whole surge of hundreds of companies whose stocks will go to zero. So this dot-com bust all over again, only worse, only bigger, only broader. Now we've got cryptos in it too. A lot of companies have taken on cryptos, and some of them are leveraged. So I think this is going to get very ugly on that end of the stock market.
I'm sorry to interrupt you here, but I meant to ask this question earlier, but now you're really getting into it, which is a few minutes ago, you had said, when we were talking about housing, you said, hey, wage price inflation is going to play a factor because it's going to increase the income in markets and support housing prices a little bit. But you and I lived out here during the dot-com bubble, and we also lived out here during the 08, crisis. We've seen what happens when this area kind of gets decimated. And we see the job losses that come along when companies have the type of stock market losses that you're talking about here, right? So with Powell deliberately going after the jobs market and letting the stock market correct in the way in which you're talking about here, my brain just has a hard time thinking that, hey, there's going to be a bunch of layoffs. Like it's a hard time really believing wage inflation is going to really be persistent because I see a lot of potential for job loss going forward.
Yeah, there are some cities that are really specialized on startups. The Bay Area, so San Francisco, Silicon Valley, Austin, Boston, some other cities have a lot of that. And already here in San Francisco, Silicon Valley, Twitter stopped hiring, Facebook stopped hiring. Uber, so Twitter and Uber both are headquartered here, or work. I think Uber's now moved to Oakland, maybe.
Before they moved to Texas or some other state, yeah.
Yeah, but so we've got hiring freezes, and that's not layoffs. We've got hiring freezes. A lot of people are leaving these companies because they already got better jobs lined up, and that's what we've got now. We've got a whole bunch of startups already laying off people, but they instantly get a job somewhere else because there's demand for labor. There's still a labor shortage.
Right,
So
but we're early in the process here. We're not
we're in
in
the
recession
process.
yet.
So right now we've got all these unfilled jobs, so people that leave somewhere, they've already got a job lined up. And the layoffs are not really showing up in unemployment because, we've got a labor shortage and they just move. Like the mortgage bankers, people are with good work experience that they can find right now in this current environment can find a job somewhere else. We would have to burn through these open jobs first before we see a big increase in unemployment. Now, locally, what that means is that if you live in an expensive city like San Francisco and you lose your job and you can't find a job in San Francisco, you may have to move somewhere else to find that job. We've been through that in the dot-com bust where people left. Already all the coastal cities lost population in 2020 and 2021. We got the data from the state of California. All of the coastal major coastal markets lost population. Some of the inland market gained population, and then California overall lost population. So we've already got that going on. Some of that was restricted immigration from Asia. Some of that was excess mortality because of COVID, and some of that was people leaving. People always leave the state, but you usually got this large influx. So we've already got that going on, So when the startup scene slows down and starts laying off, there'll be more people leaving, and that has a big impact on the housing market. There's no shortage on houses when people leave. You've got all kinds of apartments and condos and houses up for available, and so, but that's local. That is very local. The housing crisis, meaning the rents that plunged during the dot-com bust and home prices went down too, That was not the case in other markets in the United States. So that was kind of a Silicon Valley, San Francisco thing. And, you know, that didn't play out that way in other markets. So I don't know how nationwide the impact will be, but there will be an impact on the housing market here.
Yeah, yeah. And my point was less about housing and just more, you know, if the tech industry is getting hit hard, and sounds like you think the hits are going to keep coming, and it's not just going to be in the tech industry. Maybe the tech will be one of the hardest hit, but a lot of other industries are going to see somewhat similar pain. And so I just, again, you don't have to share my opinion, but to me, I have a hard time seeing wage inflation really taking off in that kind of environment, because I think a lot of the jobs, the excess jobs right now are may disappear much more quickly than maybe folks imagine, especially with the Fed essentially having declared war on them. So anyways, I don't want to rat hole on that because we only have a couple minutes left here. And I want to get to the key question of which assets, as you look ahead from here, it sounds like you see, okay, lower prices ahead. You mentioned a bear market rally. So like lots of corrections, they're going to be punctuated by, you know, reversals. Which assets do you think are going to get hit hardest, and how far and how fast do you expect the decline to be?
Yeah, so I expect many of the high-flying stocks to just go to zero. Yeah, I mean, I just expect that. I saw that during the dot-com bust. It's going to happen against a lot of these companies, well-known companies, you know. Either they go to zero and disappear because they can't make it, or they get bought for, you know, cents on the dollar by some other company for the brand name. You know, during the dot-com bust, all stocks essentially went down. Now, energy sector right now is doing pretty good. And so, I mean, you have these segments that are doing good for now, you know, but if there's a demand destruction in energy going on, then they'll take a hit. So I think overall, if you own Apple and some of the big tech companies, you know, you're in, I think, for a pretty good loss, but it's going to be there, you know. And if you have a bunch of these high flyers in your portfolio and you don't sell them, you know, you may watch them to go to zero and then they're stuck in your portfolio forever and you have to call your broker to clean them out. You can't sell them anymore. And it happened to me during the dot-com bust with a few stocks. So, I mean, people will go through that. I like cash, you know, short-term treasury securities. I'm nibbling on two-year yields a little bit. I want to sit on liquidity. I want to have the cash when opportunity comes to do something. You know, so I think bonds are an atrocious bet right now. I just, you know, if you buy bonds outright. But, you know, bond mutual funds, I think, are very risky now. And, yeah, the bonds are still, I mean, junk bonds are still in La La Land. They really, really, they haven't really come down yet. They have come down a little bit. And yields
that
have
is
come
crazy. Up. Yeah.
It's just still crazy. Yeah. So I don't, you know, it's hard to say where should we put our money? You know, I mean, my thing is that investors had it so good for so long. There comes a time when you have to give up some of it. Yeah, you just can't have it this good for so long and make all this money and then think that, oh, it's just going to keep on going. Yeah. So there comes a time you need to settle down and you need to understand, okay, unless I'm in cash, you know, if I just hang on to my assets, I'm going to give up some of this and hopefully it'll come back later. Maybe it won't, but I had it so good for so long. It's okay to give up some of it. I think a lot of investors need to come to grips with that mentality. You know, you have housing, you've got stocks, you've got bonds, you know, they've all had it really good for a very long time. And, you know, that it's, you know, you just got get used to not making money on these things.
All right. You know, it's a big mindset shift that, I mean, I think a lot of viewers watching this get this because they're the kind of people that have shared a lot of the same skepticism that you have currently about the markets. But I think the general investing populace, that's a mindset shift that's going to be tough for them to go through. And they're probably going to have to go through several of the stages of grief before they're willing to accept that and let go. All right, Wolf. such a great conversation. I'd love to keep going. We're well over our hour here. Thanks for giving us so much of your time here. Two things. One, if you were watching this and, share Wolf's opinion that, hey, this is a tough market to start investing in right now, in terms of there's not a lot of things to be bullish on right now, what do I do with my capital? Feel free to go schedule a free no strings attached portfolio review with one of the financial advisors that Wealthion connects people with. It's totally free. It's a half hour. They'll just look at your personal situation. They'll tell you what they think you should do. You don't have to work with them, but it's just a public service they offer. If you want to do that, go to wealthion.com. But Wolf, wrapping up here, people have really enjoyed this conversation with you, would like to learn more about you and your work, perhaps follow you. Where should they go?
Wolfstreet.com. That's it's free. No paywalls. We don't sell anything. It's just information, and you're going to see some ads, and that's it. And wolfstreet.com.
All right. And a lot of the excellent charts we've been showing here come from the articles that Wolf's put there. Wolf, you're also on Twitter, right? What's your Twitter handle?
Wolf off Wolf Street.
Okay, great. When we edit this, we'll put those up on the screen so folks know where to go. Yeah. And folks,
don't worry about the Twitter. I've got impersonators out there. So, just go to wolfstreet.com.
All right, great. And folks, we've talked about several of Wolf's different recent reports here. If you want to see those exact reports that basically, instigated this entire conversation, just go to wealthion.com/wolf. We'll link to those individual reports. We'll also have a link there just to the front page of wolfstreet.com as well. So you can go there and start following all of Wolf's stuff. All right. Well, now is the time on the program where we talk to the lead partners at New Harbor Financial. They're one of the financial advisory firms endorsed by Wealthion. Guys, we're going to go through and get your feedback to what Wolf said in this interview and then talk about what the markets have done over the past week, because they are doing a lot, even today as we're talking here. John Lodra, why don't I start with you? What were some of your key takeaways from what Wolf said here? He said a lot.
Yeah, he did. Wolf's always a treasure trove of perspective and depth. Talked a lot about the economy and prospect for economic recession or continued trudging along. I think it was interesting that he I think makes a decently plausible case why the negative GDP print we saw for the recent quarter, which was a big shocker negative, that perhaps the next print won't be as bad, and he articulated some good reasons for that, kind of in your imagery, Adam, of the pig working its way through the python is I think a visual that is certainly plausibly applicable to perhaps what we may see in the economic front. But I think in the same breath, I really like the fact that Wolf has talked about or talked about markets and the economy in two different lenses, I suppose, because the reality is that when markets get richly overvalued like they are now, they become disjointed from the economy. So it's not as simple as saying, well, if the recession doesn't happen or doesn't happen as soon or badly as people expect it, that doesn't mean that it's smooth sailing for asset prices in continuing an upward trajectory. Quite the opposite. Sometimes GDP prints, especially at major cyclical turning points, can be contrary indicators. If you looked at the GDP numbers in 08 and 09 at the bottom of the housing crisis, it looked like the world was coming to an end. And that was obviously a very good time to be investing heavily in stocks. By the same token, a more sanguine or more rosy print on GDP doesn't mean that the market's going to go up. It actually oftentimes is basically signifying of a potential very topping process in a very extended market.
All right. Well, topping or not, it's really interesting right now because we have more than anything, I think, just a ton of volatility, right? A ton of uncertainty, a ton of dust in the air. We had a big Q4 2021 GDP print. We then had a negative Q1 print. Wolf made a good argument that Q2 will be, more positive, more strongly positive than folks are expecting here. And I think in the markets too, you know, we've the markets have come down a lot this year so far, as we've been talking a lot about. But my goodness, I mean, the past couple of weeks, it has been lurching back and forth. We ended last week with a big rally on Friday. And I think a lot of people who were sort of closely watching this and thinking, okay, this market's going to bounce at some point, and here we go, here's the big bounce. Well, they've been disappointed this week. So the day that we're talking, Wednesday, May 18th, when we were hopping on here, the S&P was down over 4%. I think they might be trying to bounce it a little bit here, or not bounce it, but rescue it here. So maybe it's not quite down that low, but I mean, it's just been a horrible day. And so I guess where I'm going with this is, I'm not sure if this feels like a top or a bottom for people. I think they're just feeling like they're kind of torn between these shearing forces, and they're just wondering which way it's going to break. Mike, why don't we come to you next? First off, anything you want to say about the Wolf interview, but also, you know, can you speak to this sort of just big tug of war we seem to be in right now?
Yeah, I like how you just put it there, Adam. I think you said something like a struggle or the shearing, shear force of one camp versus the other. And it does feel a lot like that. We've had a market that's been so much in one direction for so long. Wolf basically said this. He said, investors have had it too good for too long, and they've got to give something back. It's true. That's exactly what's happening now. But these opposite, equal and opposite forces, those that are trying to catch the turn and you know, probably the big money or the smart money, maybe, if you will, are at opposites, are at loggerheads, and we keep going in different directions. And right now I'm seeing the market is back down more than 4% as measured by the S&P as we approach the end of the day. So I can tell you this from the front lines, there's a lot of emotion going on right now, a lot of emotion. People that are in the market or feel like they've got too much of an overexposed position are just saying, well, if I get a bounce or a bigger bounce, I'm going to get out, or I'm going to start getting out. And there's a lot of feeling frozen going on. And we would just urge people not to feel frozen, to do something, take some small steps. It's a lot easier to take another step if you do something. Let's say you were 100% in stocks. Hopefully not. But if you were, our advice would be something like this. Sell 25% right now. You know, even though the market's down 4%, do something, 10%, 25%, something. Because I think that based on math and based on our study of the markets over our entire careers and the data that we see, this market is very, very, very overvalued even here. And you won't be regretting those sales probably down the road, even if they turned out to be ill-timed. But what it will do for you is it will let you get unstuck. Worst thing you can do is get stuck. And then if this does become another 0809 or 0002, you won't be stuck watching it go all the way down. Because if we were to have another big drop from here or a mini crash, which is completely possible, we can't predict it, of course, but if it were to happen, we can guarantee you that you won't want to do much of anything after that happens. So some action is a lot better than none. At the moment, it looks like the market wants to roll over and maybe take out those recent lows. If that happens, the market could fall easily to 3,500, 3,600, you know, quickly on the S&P. So a lot of emotion going on here. This has been a market that's been one way for far too long, completely driven by central bank money printing. And it's been trying to top. Really, if you look at the market as measured by the Wilshire 5000, it topped in November. If you look at the S&P, it was January 4th. So we're almost 6 months into that or more, depending upon how you measure it. And I can only say that we're going to continue to watch and react to it.
All right, great. Look, I want to get to, you know, how you guys are trading this right now, what decisions you might be making kind of in real time. But before I get there, I want to just emphasize that point about emotions, because you know, anybody watching obviously the tape today probably pretty shell-shocked by how you know, violently the market's moved down today. But you know, in that chorus around that, you know, crazy market activity, we're seeing folks like Jeremy Grantham, who was just back on TV basically saying, hey, yeah, you know, that massive, you know, 50% correction that I was, you know, predicting last year, well, we're in the midst of it, and it's going, the market's still going a lot lower from here, right? I interviewed Ted Oakley from Oxbow Capital yesterday, and he said, look, you know, the decline in the market so far this year has been pretty orderly. So he said, to me, that really doesn't seem like margin calls have been getting triggered yet. You know, he thought that there was really sort of so much excess in the system, so many gains in the system, that we haven't yet come down to the level where margin calls are getting triggered. But he said, hey, look, if we fall, you know, much further from here, we're going to get to that space, and then we're going to trigger another waterfall of forced selling. So to your point, Mike, you know, if this thing is rolling over, you know, then the danger gets increasingly, you know, dangerous, because we get into that zone where, you know, all of a sudden we can start triggering these big, you know, kind of airdrop moments in the market. So, you know, understandably, emotions are tense and getting tenser as those shearing forces I mentioned, you know, continue to fight against each other here. But your comment there reminded me of a video that I put out at the beginning of this year, and I'll put up a link to it right here, which was titled "Don't Be a Deer in the Headlights." And what I was telling people in it was saying, hey, look, you know, if the market, there's so much risk in the markets right now that if they begin to fall at the magnitude we think they can, what happens to a lot of people in a decline that big is they get frozen. And you were just saying that, Mike, and they don't know what to do. They're sitting on losses. They don't want to sell and lock in those losses. But they don't want to be exposed to further losses if this market drawdown is going to really, you know, have some legs to it. So they just panic and freeze, which is really kind of one of the worst things you can do at a time like this. So it sounds like, Mike and John, you are seeing people that are in that state. Mike, you gave a really good bit of advice there, which is to say, hey, just start doing something. Just start getting some forward momentum. I know on this channel, I spend a lot of time every week, you know, reinforcing my advice that people should work with a professional financial advisor. That was equally true at the beginning of the year as it is right now. But I think even in moments like this, it's even more important, because your emotions are kind of shouting in your head. They're putting you in that paralysis state. You want to begin to get sort of the calm, dispassionate counsel of somebody that's seen environments like this before, can look at your personal situation and start giving you some potential ideas to start considering so that you can start taking some action. So, John, let me punt it back to you for a second. You know, if somebody's watching this and they're feeling like, yeah, Adam just described me, I'm kind of in this frozen state. If they were to call you guys, like, kind of, how can you help a person like that?
Yeah, well, first of all, we want to bring it back to their situation. And this is a psychological phase, right? That's what happens. And we're humans. Every one of us has a tendency to be psychologically affected in bargaining, you know, when should I get out, when should I get in, and that kind of thing. And it's a unique, each person probably has a unique set of circumstances or mindset, you know. So for example, someone who's been heavily invested in stocks for the last several years has seen a very dramatic run up in the value of their stocks. There's no doubt about that. Almost no matter where they've been invested. Obviously some stocks have gotten hit more significantly recently than others. And you and Wolf talked a lot about the high flyers, some of which are down, you know, 60, 70, 80, 90%. So certainly those stocks have given back a lot of, and maybe they're going to zero. But broadly speaking, the markets are still down very little, and you know, we're back to kind of where we were, you know, this time a little earlier than this last year. So, you know, in the context of someone who's ridden this up over several years, certainly should not feel, you know, kind of trapped in that you missed the top. It's perhaps a little bit more difficult psychological dilemma for someone who, you know, perhaps was not invested for the last several years and kind of jumped into the markets late last year, or earlier this year, and now are perhaps feeling a sting of perhaps perfect wrong timing. Even there, it's important to keep perspective because things can drop a whole lot further. And there is definitely protective and thoughtful things one can do today, even if it means booking some losses, because and there's ways to not make it a binary decision. You know, we have hedging tools we can use, for example, to help, you know, take some of the sting out of being wrong on timing. But all to say, it's a very when we get in major, volatile periods like this, especially after a long trend, each person can have a, you know, an entirely different but equally entrapping psychological dilemma.
All right. All right. Well, well said there, John. All right. I mentioned I was going to ask you guys about, you know, whether you're making trades right now or whether you're sort of in a hunker mode with the portfolio as currently positioned. And Mike, I'll come back to you for this. And if you can, the last couple of times we've talked, the market, you know, we've remarked how the market's been down, you know, S&P down, what, you know, 17%+, might be actually more than that today. I haven't done the most recent math. NASDAQ obviously down closer to 30%. Your general portfolio has been basically flat, maybe even up a little bit. Do you have any update on that to provide for this week?
It's roughly the same, Adam. It's pretty close to the same as when we reported last time. Roughly flat on the year at the moment.
Okay. And John mentioned there, you know, sort of hedging techniques that you can help people do. Again, last time we talked, I know your biggest position or one of your biggest positions is in the precious metal miners. And you talked about how, you know, GDX had fallen down to about the level that the put protection that you had in place would start to cover future losses. Is that working out as intended?
Yes, in our main, you know, in our main model, we have, as we've mentioned before many times, a core position in gold miners, and you know, the vehicle that we generally use is GDX, and I often mention it as a proxy for the gold mining complex. GDX had a pretty breathtaking move, as did almost all stocks in the metals and mining complex. I mean, GDX went to 40, you know, to 41 when gold went up above 2000 just a couple of weeks ago, and then promptly fell 10 points or 25% to 31. I'm taking a look at a chart right now. When we had that move up towards 40, we used it as an opportunity to hedge that stock or to hedge that sector. We sold call options on a part of that position, only on half, because selling a call option puts a ceiling on the price of the stock where you forego any more gains above them, above that level. But then we use the premium or the money we brought in from that to buy some insurance. And this is called a collar. In this case, a costless collar or a zero cost collar. We use the money from those call options to buy put options down at 33 in this example. So, and it didn't cost anything to do that. And, you know, in hindsight, is 2020. I mean, maybe the timing was, you know, lucky or unlucky, depending upon which, how you look at it, but that fell even faster than we thought it would. And we're in the money on our hedge. You know, GDX is presently trading at around 30 and a half. So it's nice to have put options because you can sit back and let the trade just be for a while and let it bottom and then bounce. And while we don't have any further exposure to the downside, at least in that position or in that sector.
All right. Well, I appreciate you walking through the math there, because what I want folks to take away from this is we talk about risk management, we talk about hedging. This is a real world example of how putting those hedges in place have actually stopped you know, the downward exposure, the downward vulnerability of your largest position or one of your largest positions. And people can recreate this in their own portfolio for other positions that they may hold as well. So we've been long warning about or long advising the wisdom of using hedges. Now events, for better or worse, are proving, you know, how well these things work when you need to rely on them, if they've been put in place intelligently.
I guess I would just add, you know, to be fair and balanced, there is still some, you know, downside deductible that you have to pay. I mean, for instance, the drop from 41 to 33 still gets felt in that example in the account. The key is that it's just a plan. It's an insurance policy, instead of using a stop loss, it just gives you another plan to mitigate risk.
Right. And probably the way to think about it is you know, like with your car. Right, you get in a little fender bender, you know, you're paying that deductible, even if you don't get in any accidents, that money's going out the door. You get in a little fender bender, well, you got to pay the deductible, you know, maybe it's about as much as the repair. But if you get in a really big collision, you're protected from that larger damage once you've paid your deductible. All right, John, I want to come back to you. So I think anybody who is watching the interview here with Wolf, who's a homeowner, you know, probably got a little bit of the fear of God in them when he talked about what he thinks is going to happen to the housing market. You guys, have a lot of clients who, you know, are homeowners and whatnot. How do people tend to grapple with the math of, you know, I want to project forward, let's say a year, right? If things transpire the way that Wolf thinks they will, it sounds like he said, hey, look, yeah, the economy might actually, you know, do a little bit better for a little bit longer than folks expect. But in terms of asset prices, both financial assets and home prices, he expects them to get really whacked hard. How do you help people kind of mentally prepare for that? Because, you know, for a lot of people, they calculate their net worth and they're putting the latest Zillow price on their house, which has only been going up and up and up for the past 10 years. What would your counsel be to somebody, you know, who's trying to sort of steel themselves for what Wolf's talking about here?
Yeah, I think the first thing, Adam, is just try to help them zoom out a bit and look at, you know, where things are and where they can and should be based upon historical precedents. Apologize for the closing bell there on my monitor. But, you know, so for example, I thought it was really brilliant that Wolf talked about even a large decline in house prices would only get us to, like, you know, last year, right? And you know, in his logic, not that many people bought homes. So it's kind of like, it was a paper thing. But there is a psychological, you know, courage, I suppose, that, you know, knowing that your house is appreciated, you know, 50% or 75% in the last couple of years, it emboldens folks to maybe spend or do things that they otherwise wouldn't have the courage to do. And of course, it works in reverse. And that's what, you know, Wolf talked a lot about. You know, the Fed, you know, intentionally used the wealth effect to drive behavior by inflating asset prices. And they're going to have to intentionally use the wealth effect in reverse, you know, take away the wealth effect by, you know, bringing in asset prices intentionally by interest rate rises. You know, we try to help folks understand that, you know, what has happened isn't real, you know, in terms of real and sustainable, and thankfully people don't want to and can't sell their house typically, you know, in a panic because it's where they live and they need a place to go to work. But that's where financial assets can see elevator drops because there is no such, you know, handcuffs. You know, folks can hit the eject button at a panic and feel like they're, you know, the problem is that usually happens too late or later in the process. You know, people bargain with themselves. So I'll sell a little bit now and I'll just wait till I get my other, you know, all-time highs. But that's the very thing that can cause this buildup of people hitting the panic button without almost thinking about it. And oftentimes that happens for folks after they've suffered a, you know, 30, 40, 50% decline in a major bear market. So our tool, our approach is firstly to try and illuminate for folks where we are in the cycle so they can really truly understand that a 30 or 40 or 50% drop or more in the markets or housing prices is not at all an anomaly. It's actually probably a very good expectation as a base case scenario based upon history.
All right. So just to kind of build on that, if we think that asset prices have a good probability or possibility of still going lower over time, if we think it's possible / probable that the housing market's going to have a material correction, if the cost of debt is going up, which it is as long as the Fed is going to continue raising rates here, and if at some point we believe a recession is going to hit, right, which potentially could come with layoffs and job loss, just trying to give you guys an opportunity to maybe, you know, talk to folks who are viewing this here and just saying, hey, these are some of the things that we would encourage you guys to do, start thinking about doing now in advance of the arrival of these potential developments so that if they in fact do happen, you're better positioned today than you were then. And I'll toss one out there to let you guys react to, but is now a good time to sort of start deleveraging in your household balance sheet? John, why don't we start with you to finish it and then we'll go to Mike.
Yeah, I think absolutely, yes. You know, there is a couple schools of thought there. If interest rates are going higher, you know, why not keep current lower interest rate debt, you know, productive debt, be it mortgages or business loans or things like that in the books. But the key there is to not be over-levered. You know, having a modest amount of leverage and debt on your balance sheet, personal balance sheet, there's nothing entirely wrong with that, provided that you know, you have the ability to service that debt. Either you've got savings that you can turn to in a pinch if one were to lose their job, or whatever, or, you know, a solid rental income on a property that you might have a mortgage on. The problem is when those guaranteed forms of income to service that debt become not so guaranteed. And that's where default comes in. And that's, it doesn't matter what the interest rate is on that debt, you know, you should be deleveraging, and deleveraging gives you staying power and security. And, you know, Wolf talked about corporate America is hugely indebted right now. And that's not going to look good. That's why, you know, it's not inconceivable that a bunch of companies go to zero because they simply will not be able to service the debt.
You have the contagion amongst the zombie companies, right? Exactly.
Yeah.
All right, Mike, anything to add on that before we begin to wrap things up here?
In conversations, I use the word simplify, but I think it's saying the same thing as John just talked about, you know, deleveraging. I might say simplify. Just simplify, simplify, simplify. You know, consider paying down debt. Some people have assets they're not sure about they want to have long term, like maybe they have a second or even a third investment property or even a vacation home. There's a good example. And they may feel like it's time to simplify, or they might simply think about simplifying by selling a large home they've lived in, but now they're empty nesters. And you know, it would be a really good time to think about selling that and to downsize here. So any big decision you're making here financially should be towards the simplification side of the ledger.
All right. Well, that's good advice. And it builds on a conversation we were having right before we turned the camera on here, Mike, which is you were talking about a recent post by John Hussman, which essentially made the case for, hey, if you expect there to be materially lower asset prices ahead, that there is a first mover advantage here, right? You know, that let's use the housing market as an example. You know, you don't have to sell your house for your house to go down in value, right? All that needs to happen is somebody else in your neighborhood has to sell a similar home for a lower price. And then that's the new price for homes like that in the neighborhood, right? So at some point, if we do go into a housing correction, it's going to be the people selling their homes, you know, that are going to be setting the lower price. Well, if you're one of the first to sell and you sell nearer where the current price is today, well, you're one of the people that's kind of getting out near the top, right? If you wait, that decision's going to be taken away from you. And I'm not necessarily encouraging people to rush out and sell their homes, but I'm just saying to your point there, Mike, you should sort of take an audit of what you have, you know, prioritize what you want to hold, what you're not holding so tightly to emotionally, and things that are in that second budget bucket, you might want to start saying, okay, how do I start unloading this stuff rather than just writing them down? I see you nodding as I'm saying this.
Yeah, I mean, if you're in $1 million home and you've really been itching to move somewhere else in the country and move to a $300,000 or $400,000 home to downsize, I mean, now would be a great time to do it. If you've moved and you've got a house in, you know, one of the coasts, you know, West Coast or East Coast, and you're somewhere else in the country and you've decided to rent out that house that you left behind, but you don't really think you're ever going back there, and it might be a good time to sell. We still have a very strong housing market, and just to liquidate that holding and guarantee you almost always once you sell it, you might find yourself not emotionally attached to it anymore. And so that's kind of the simplification that we're talking about. But if you're in your primary house and you're going to stay there the rest of your life, don't worry about it. The 20 or 30% or, you know, whatever the hypothetical decline may be is not going to hurt you. But if you've got a more complicated situation with a few different lines out there, so to speak, with properties and other assets that may not totally fit into your future in terms of simplification, now would be a really good time to think about letting them go.
All right. Well said. Well, as we wrap things up here, yeah, let's underscore simplification and not being a deer in the headlight. And folks, if you're feeling, you know, like things are a little too complicated in your financial life, you got a lot of questions, a lot of worries, or you're feeling like that deer in the headlight, just a reminder that, you know, we think you should be talking about these issues with a professional financial advisor. If you've got a great one, good, stick with them. But if you don't, or you'd like a second of opinion, of a advisor that really gets and understands and takes into consideration the macro risk factors that Wolf talked about, just go to wealthion.com and we'll help set you up with a free, no strings attached, no commitment, 30-minute consultation with one of the experts that we recommend, John and Mike here at New Harbor being at the top of that list. John, I'm going to go to you just to give you the last word here. Any parting counsel for folks as we wind things up?
No, just take a breath. Talk to your trusted advisor if you have one. We'd happy to, like you said, we'd be happy to have a review consultation with any folks that feel like they need or want another objective opinion. Know that there is no right and wrong, and this business of investing is not about precision. It's about making sure that things are shifted in a way that makes sense with the risk and reward environment and your own situation. And so many people, especially at major high points in market, take way more risk than they need to have the kind of security they want and need. And even if they need the returns or feel they need the returns, the simple matter is when markets are very overpriced, those returns are not going to be likely given. You know, markets don't care what one needs. They're priced to give what they're going to give. And so just take a step back, educate yourself, consult an advisor, whatever you can do to take some of the, the unanswered questions are the ones that cause the most, unasked and unanswered questions are the ones that cause the most stress. So we encourage you to ask those questions and we're happy to do that with you.
Great. I know you know this, John, my wife's a marriage family therapist. Exact same thing there too. It's the unanswered questions that are the ones that create the biggest problems down the road. So, all right. Well, look, John and Mike, thanks so much for giving us so much of your time today. Everybody else, if you've enjoyed this interview with Wolf and would like to see more great guests like him on this program, please support this channel by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below. And John and Mike, whatever happens next from here, we will be tracking it next week on this program together. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
Thanks a lot, Adam. We'll see you soon.
Bye, Adam. See you next week.
If you'd like to schedule a consultation with one of the financial advisors at New Harbor Financial, simply go to wealthion.com. These consultations are completely free and there are no strings attached. The good folks at New Harbor will simply answer any questions you have about your investment goals or your portfolio and give you their best advice given their latest market outlook. They're willing to do this because they care about protecting people's wealth. And because Wealthion has connected them with so many thoughtful investors just like you over the past decade. We started doing this because so many people have approached us in frustration, looking for a solution because they're feeling out of alignment or downright ridiculed by the standard financial advisors who have been managing their money. You know the type. The kind that just pushes all of your money into the market, scoffs at the idea of owning gold, and when you bring up concerns about the market's sky-high valuations, they say, "Don't worry. The market will always take care of you." For many of the reasons discussed in today's video, we think this is one of the most challenging and treacherous times in history for investing. We strongly believe that today's investors are best served working in partnership with a conscientious professional financial advisor who understands the risks in play. Now, we're agnostic which professional advisor you work with, as long as they're good. If you're already working with one, that's fantastic. Stick with them. But if you don't, or are having trouble finding one you respect or trust, then consider talking to John and Mike and the team at New Harbor. Now, for those about to ask, yes, there's a business relationship between Wealthion and New Harbor, which we've put in place to make sure everything is handled according to SEC regulations. All the details on this are clearly provided on the Wealthion.com website. Also, it's important to note that New Harbor is able to work with U.S. citizens, green card holders, and those with existing assets in the USA. But for regulatory reasons, they aren't able to take on non-US clients. All right, with all that said, if you'd like some insight and guidance on how to protect your wealth during this unprecedented time in the markets, go to wealthion.com to schedule your free consultation with the good folks at New Harbor. Thanks for watching.